This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24/7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books in Sports, a channel on the New Books Network. My name is Keith Rathbone. I'm a senior lecturer at Macquarie University, and I'm coming to you from Sydney, Australia. And I have the immense pleasure of speaking today with Stephanie Convery, who is an author and an inequality reporter for Guardian Australia. And Stephanie is the author of just a fantastic book that I had the pleasure to read a little while ago, and I'm really excited to speak to you about today, Stephanie. The book is After the Count, The Death of Davy Brown. It's out with Penguin in 2020. Stephanie, I really loved reading this book, and I just wanted to know, first of all, how you came up with this project.
Thank you. It's really nice to be speaking to you finally. I know we've been talking about this for a long time, so I'm really glad to be talking a bit more about this book with you, Keith. The start of the project is a little bit convoluted, and I'm going to go into a little bit of an anecdote, if that's all right with you.
Absolutely, yeah.
So I lived in Melbourne when I was first started thinking about this as an issue as boxing as a sport, but also the complications of a sport that is essentially violent. So it's controlled and scored and all of that. It's all violence, even though it is a sport. So I actually got into boxing before I got into thinking about boxing, because I had a bum knee from trying to run a marathon. So I had signed up for some reason for a marathon on the Great Wall of China. I thought, if I'm going to run a marathon, it's probably going to be the only time in my life that I will do this. I'm not somebody who naturally finds running fun. I do it because I think, you know, the adrenaline is good, and sometimes you feel a bit great while you're doing it, but it's very good exercise, and so that's why I was doing it. But I like having a goal, and I thought, okay, well, I'll stretch myself because I also have a tendency to try to do that. If I'm going to run a marathon, I'm going to do it somewhere cool. I'll do it on the Great Wall of China. There's a group that runs these adventure marathons, and one of them was in China, so I signed up for that. And then about 3 weeks before the marathon, look, in all honesty, I hadn't been stretching properly. This is something that everybody should be doing when they're trying to run a marathon, is stretch after you train. But I wasn't doing that, and I stuffed my knee. I still went to China, but I only ran half a marathon, not a full marathon. And then after I came back, I had to do a whole lot of rehab, and my physio told me that I couldn't do any cardio unless I wanted to swim. Or the only other thing that I could potentially do while I was rehabbing my knee was box. And I think she probably meant, like, just going to the local kind of mainstream gym and doing a class with a personal trainer or something. But of course I was like, oh no, I'm going to go start boxing now. And I went into this dingy gym in central Melbourne under the train station, and sort of signed up for boxing. And that was my first introduction into it. And it was such an exhilarating, unexpected, high training as a boxer that I got really fascinated by it. And while I was training, I think it had been about maybe a year and a half after I started training, I was thinking about sport more generally and the politics of the body, and was trying to work on a creative project, a writing project. I wasn't working at The Guardian at the time. I was doing working in arts and culture, literary magazines. I was the deputy editor of Overland Literary Magazine here. And so I was thinking about art, I was thinking about the body, I was thinking about politics, I was thinking about feminism and Marxism and all those different kinds of isms that can intersect with body politics, and trying to come up with something to write about that. And then my partner sent me a link to a news article about a boxer who had just died in Sydney. And I thought, oh, this is really awful for a start, but also this is kind of the epitome of why people don't like boxing. And I enjoy it, but I also understand that it's violent and it can be really confronting and it can lead to people being killed. And I thought, well, maybe I could investigate this a little bit. So I sent off a bunch of emails. I tried to call people who might have been involved or related to the incident, and I got nothing, absolutely nothing. And the project kind of faded away. And then I got this job in Sydney working for The Guardian. And so I was on the culture desk. So I was doing arts and reviews and features in the culture space, not at all in sport. And I moved to Sydney for that job. And then the week that I moved to Sydney, I got a message from the boxer's wife. And she said, it was about 9 months later. And she said, if you'd still like to do a story, I'd be happy to help. And that was sort of where it started. And where it ended is this whole book just devoted to this particular issue and this particular event. That was a very long way of telling you about how this book started.
No, but honestly, I find it fascinating to hear. One of the things I love about doing the podcast is hearing how people come up with their projects and how they get to things. And it's very often some of the best work comes through these circuitous pathways. And I think you can feel it in your book, actually, because your book's not a straightforward kind of investigative account of this. It actually incorporates a lot of your personal history, as well as the history of boxing, especially boxing in Australia more writ large. So when I'm reading it, I'm reading kind of investigative journalism, I'm reading history, I'm reading memoir. Can you tell us a little bit about when you're writing this project, how you're putting it together? How did you want to situate it in terms of genre and just as a writing challenge and as a fascinating kind of approach to talking about boxing?
I think as I was researching the book, so Danny Brown's wife, Amy, the first day that I met her, she showed me the video of Danny's fight, which at that time I knew that no other journalist had seen because I'd read all the coverage and I had kind of been making notes about what had happened. And at that point, when I first met her, I didn't know that I would be writing a book about Davey. It wasn't until I saw the video and I saw what happened in the video. And I don't want to kind of ruin it for anybody who might want to read the book, because I did try to put a few cliffhangers and reveals in there. But I mean, if you'd read the news coverage, you would know what happened. And there was quite a lot of it, particularly around the inquest that later happened. But at that time, nobody in the media had seen the video of the fight. In fact, I don't even know if many people even knew it existed. I knew that often fights were taped, but I didn't necessarily think at the time that she would have a copy of the tape. The police obviously had a copy of the tape, but I didn't think that she would. And while watching it, because I had not been there, I'd only been relying on media reports. Watching it, I had this sudden sense. There's a sense that you get as a journalist, and I didn't realize that it was kind of a journalist's sense at the time. I'm an accidental journalist. I started out as a creative writer. I studied creative writing. I wanted to write fiction. I was always in the arts. I wasn't in news per se. So I didn't realize this was a journalist thing. But that there's this rush of adrenaline that you get when you realize you have something that nobody else has. When you realize something bigger has happened than you thought, or that you found something bigger than you thought. And that's what happened in that room. I remember leaving Amy's house afterwards thinking, my God, this is huge. Like, there are so many failures in this event. So many points where this didn't have to be the outcome. So many points where it could have been stopped if people had done something differently. People had seen things that we could see in hindsight were so clear in the course of the fight. He didn't have to die. It was like, I believed 100% at that moment that this was a preventable death, and that there were a whole bunch of failures that had happened. And I knew that I had something that was worth something bigger than just what I had sort of envisaged it might be earlier in the process, of like a chapter in a bigger book about all different kinds of sports. I was like, no, this is the story. And at the time, the inquest into Davey's death hadn't happened. The police hadn't even finished their investigation, I don't think. Those things take forever. Anybody who's been involved in courts, the processes of courts in Australia, regardless of whether they're criminal or otherwise, like, they take a long time. And it was scheduled for May the following year. So in some ways it was sort of perfect timing, because I had this information that nobody else had, and I had all this time to kind of build up to it. But your question was about genre. So after that point, when I decided that I was going to write a book about this incident, and with Amy's help, had access to a lot of things that I didn't otherwise expect, including later on the coronial documents, which were incredibly, incredibly useful. I thought narrative nonfiction was probably the way to go. It needed to be a story. I didn't want to do an academic kind of analysis of it. It wasn't a biography, because it wasn't Davey's. Even though Davey's life was sort of important to build an understanding of him, actually what happened to him and how he died was the kind of crux of the issue. And I had been, one of the things that I read when I am stressed or tired or whatever is detective novels, and I watch a lot of crime fiction.
This is every academic secret vice is crime novels. I swear to you.
Honestly, crime novels and Georgette Heyer romances, but the romances didn't come into this one. It was the crime novel, the detective novels specifically, and I watch a lot of crime drama, so I am very attuned to the narrative beats of a crime novel and narrative beats of crime TV. I love it. And I thought, this actually like could fit that shape. And not only could it fit that shape in terms of, like, I'm investigating this thing that has happened. I don't know what I think about it yet, other than that it was horrific and shouldn't have happened. But there are all of these characters. There's a natural kind of narrative arc in my learning about what happened, going to the inquest, kind of trying to speak to different people, trying to come to an understanding at the end of it. But there's also this, all of this like rich history about boxing and as a sport, as a kind of always slightly seedy and underground culture, incredibly masculine and male dominated, and I'm a woman, so there's a perfect kind of narrative tension there. Just thinking about this entirely as a literary project, quite apart from the fact that I had like personal investment in that, what it's like to be a woman boxer. And all of those things kind of created a nice little natural structure for the book. And even to that, I thought, okay, well, I can insert what I have learned about the sport, about the history, about violence. I think that's the other thing. There's a natural issue. There are natural issues in that, in boxing as a subject in this particular incident. So interrogating that and being able to bring in kind of, it's a bit of a sad fact that if you have done a bit of reading, you've done a bit of academic reading, you've done a bit of sort of wider reading more generally, if you can bring in some of that into a sort of popularly accessible nonfiction book, it just adds weight that often isn't there in some other nonfiction. So I wanted to be able to bring in that stuff. Like, I'd read Foucault, I read Marx, I had ideas about this. My partner is also a writer and a researcher, and he and I would just like talk about this all the time. What does it mean to be engaged in a sport that is basically violent? how is it different to something like Australian rules football or rugby or I don't know, ballet? Like how is it different? How is it similar? What are we kind of drawing on when we play those sports or do those physical activities? What does it mean to be both empowered by it and realize that you're hurting someone else at the same time? And can you consent to being hurt? Can you consent to a circumstance in which you are going to be physically impaired as a consequence of, or possibly as a consequence of doing it? And then there was the other key issue that was coming up all the time at the time, and still is, was concussion in sport. And the Australian media at the time kind of hadn't really started pushing on that in the way that I think they had in the US. So the NFL had already settled, I think, that major case that the former players had brought against them. I think it's the current players, I can't remember. Yeah, but they had a whole lot of big
players, yeah.
Former players.
Yeah.
So there are a whole lot of big moves that happened there. Do you want
to... Well, I wanted to add in too, because I've read the book, but people who are listening probably won't necessarily have read the book. But I mean, I could have imagined, one of the things I loved about the book is you could have just done like that kind of parallelism between the academic study and then the event and the academic study, you know, but you also overlaid your own history into it. So when you're talking about, I mean, I don't want to jump ahead too far or reveal things you don't necessarily you want to reveal the book, but you alternate again with chapters of your own experiences as a boxer, kind of as you're doing the project. So you're learning kind of, you know, as you're reading Foucault, but then you're punching somebody in the face, forgetting this yourself. So I wondered, yes, of course you have there's a extensive bibliography, you know, of academic sources, but I also think you learned a lot and I learned a lot from reading about your experiences as a boxer and how you were kind of, because sometimes it felt like you were working through academic texts to understand pain and violence. And other times you were like dealing with pain violence in an entirely different way. And so I guess, can you talk to us a little bit about, you know, when did you realize your own life was part of the story you were trying to tell, I guess?
I think it sort of became obvious that was going to need to be in there because part of the way that I was starting to understand sport was through my own experiences. And I wanted to be able to tell the reader, who I thought would probably not, might be interested in the idea of boxing, but actually think it was kind of abhorrent or be against it. And I wanted to have those readers come along with me as a writer, even though they might disagree with the sport more generally, because that is a real thing, right? Like there are a lot of people who think boxing shouldn't exist, and that's fine. I don't necessarily agree with them when it comes to that or what should be done about it, but I wanted them to want to be able to read the book too. And I thought, the book is not about me per se. My story is subordinate. I always wanted my story to be subordinate to David Brown's story. If I was in there, it had to just be as a vehicle for people to understand Davey and the issues more in a way that they wouldn't necessarily be able to do that if I wasn't in there. Like I had to add to the story, but not make it all about me. So
That comes through, by the way, very clear.
Oh, great! Oh, that
comes through. No, it doesn't read. It doesn't read like. It doesn't read. It doesn't read as a memoir first, but it does add. And I think there's a great history of this actually in boxing, where scholars kind of take on, where they're like, I kind of really understand fighting unless I do it.
right. Exactly. I mean, I'm not Norman Mailer, and I don't say that I think he is amazing, but like he made the fight all about himself, and I didn't want to do that. But I also think that there is something about boxing and about a sport like that is so adrenaline fueled and so kind of exhilarating and also terrifying that you have to understand in your body and you have to be able to describe about our physical experience. And so the only way to do that is to do it yourself. You can listen to fighters describe it, you can, you know, But I thought, like, honestly, the best way to do that is by talking about how it actually feels, because that's how I understood why people do it. Why Davey Brown, like, kept going back into the ring. Like, why all those sports people who have been injured time and time again, who maybe, like, have lost just, you know, 20 fights in a row and still keep going back. Why do they do that? They do that because of the way it feels. Not only that, sometimes there's money involved and all sorts of other kinds of things, but I really think at the bottom of it is how it feels in your body. And I think that being able to talk about that from my own perspective, also because I'm a woman, and being a woman in those very low-key spaces, and they can be really intimidating and quite scary sometimes, those spaces, puts a different spin on it, because boxing has always been considered a man's sport. And while there are women who do it and do it very well, and that has kind of changing, I think that gender dynamic is a really kind of key thing to understand about the sport and about sporting environments and about the way that it feels in your body too. Because I think it does change the kind of narrative a little bit when we talk about the way women feel when we box. I mean, it's pretty much the same. Like the same hormones, the same kind of, but it's still adrenaline. It's still like you're still punching someone else. It's the same act, it's the same feeling, but because the social structures around us are different, it can kind of mean something different for a woman to be boxing. And for how that feels for a woman to have that kind of power in her body, that means something different socially too. So those sorts of things, I think, were much easier kind of explored if I was in there a bit as well. And again, like, not to overshadow Davey's story, but to kind of add to this sort of layers of understanding I was trying to build in the reader about, to ultimately get to the point of, like, why does it matter the circumstances in which this guy died and the things that other people around him could have done? Why does that matter, and how can we change it if things went wrong?
Yeah, that really comes through, and I don't want to jump too far ahead, but one of the things that I was thinking about at the end of the book was kind of the future of boxing, but also the possibilities of kind of a feminist future of boxing that was different than what boxing is now. And what I mean when I say feminist future of boxing is not like a boxing just for women, but like a boxing that is about a kind of more feminist understanding of what sport might be and how that was working for you. But look, I take your point. You've mentioned it twice, so I think we should move there and actually center Davey now in the conversation a bit. And so maybe you can tell us a bit about who Davey Brown was and a bit about what happened to him. I mean, as you mentioned, it's not a biography. It's not the life and death of Davey Brown. This is after the count, the death of Davey Brown. So can tell us just a little bit about who he is and what happened to him.
So Davey Brown was a 20-something boxer in Sydney. He was a professional. He'd been fighting since he was a kid. So his father was into boxing. He got Davey and his brother Tommy into boxing when they were about 10 or 11. And Davey was really good at it. In fact, they both were. They were both professionals eventually. So he fought all... He had hundreds and hundreds of fights when he was under 18. By the time he turned 18, he was pretty much ready to go as a pro. And so he started having professional fights in his after he turned 18. And I mean, you know, in Australia, professional fights are generally not very well paid. They're a couple of thousand dollars if you're lucky. So he was working as a laborer as well. He had a young wife, Amy, and two young boys. So he was a bit of a family man. He was, they lived, you know, out in Campbelltown in the outer suburbs of Sydney. He grew up out there. So Davey came to this particular fight, with a kind of eye on hoping to get a world title eventually. And this, the title of the fight? It was the IBF. One moment, please. Sorry, it's been a while since I've...
There's so many different titles in boxing. Sometimes it's hard.
One of the guys I know who writes about boxing a lot calls it the alphabet soup of boxing. I think it's the IBF Pan Pacific something. Yeah.
So, I mean, even he was hoping to get an eventual bid for a title bout. And
that's right.
Yeah.
So, with apologies to your listeners, I finished writing this book 3 years ago. For a little while.
I couldn't tell you what I wrote this morning, so you're doing quite well.
So this was a sort of stepping stone title, basically. And the idea was, if you get a few of these sorts of stepping stone titles, you are more likely to be a contender for something really big. And the really big ones come with more money, they come with more prestige, they come with, you know, glory, etc. So he was fighting a Filipino guy, Carlo Magali, who was brought over from the Philippines specifically for this fight. And the kind of general understanding was that Davey was a sure thing. He was really good. I don't think this was ever explicit, or maybe it was explicitly stated in the inquest, but again, the general understanding was that that his opponent had been chosen, not because he would be a knockout, like a pushover, sorry, but because he would give a good fight, but Davey would win. Like, this sort of...
this is how boxing works, right? Yeah.
This is how boxing works. It's so corrupt. I'm not meant to say that there was, like, overt corruption here. But it is generally understood to be very carefully structured so as to give particular people the best opportunity to move up in their career, if that's the idea. So the fight was actually financed by Davey's father, and the whole mom was. There was a lot of money that went into it. There were about 5 fights that happened that night, and Davey's was the main event. And it was a 12-round bout, as they often are, 3 minutes a round. And Davey was doing pretty well in the first 5 or 6 rounds, and then he got a big hit in the... It's unclear whether it was the 5th or the 6th round, because the various witnesses' testimonies changed. I think it was the 6th. And everyone was like, oh, that's not good. He doesn't look good. He kept fighting, though, and he sort of seemed to come back a bit. And then in the 11th round, he got knocked down, and he was given an 8 count. So that's when, if you're not familiar with the various...
You need to explain this. The boxing listeners know what you're talking about.
Oh, yes.
The others don't.
So when you get knocked down in boxing, that's when you lose your footing and you end up wholly or at least partially on the floor. The referee will come over and they'll count to 8, and that's the 8 count. And you have that amount of time to kind of collect yourself and get back up and start fighting. Or if you stay down after the 8 count, then you lose. So he got up. He used pretty much almost all of the 8 to kind of to stay down and go. Like, it's kind of like a breather in some ways. But and then he got up and then he kept fighting. And then he got hit again very soon after that and fell back against the ropes of the ring. And then the bell rang. He went back to his corner. And when you look at the tape, you can really, in fact, it might be still some, there are some bootlegs circulating online, although I don't think they've done that with the permission of the family. So ethically, probably not a good idea to go and watch it. But there were some news reports later that showed the footage. So it is sort of still out there. He got knocked back against the ropes and sort of like wobbled back to his corner. And in the corner, they're clearly really worried about him, and they were pouring water all over him, and they were like, he was sitting there kind of just on his little stool kind of staring out. And then the bell rang for the 12th round, and Davey didn't get up immediately, and the referee got kind of miffed about it because Carlo Magali was out in the middle of the ring and he was ready to fight. The referee went over to the corner and basically like told his corner to get out of the ring so that the fight could continue. It later came out in the inquest that they had been engaging in some stalling tactics in the corner because they were worried about Davey being able to go forward with the next round, and they wanted to give him as much time as possible to recover. They at the time, I don't think they sort of had the language for what was happening to him, but they clearly knew something was wrong. And Davey came out, and he was not the same fighter he'd been 2 rounds before. He was sort of his guard was loose. He was really sluggish. He was not kind of sharp in his movements or anything like that. And within about 10 seconds, Khalid Mabali knocked him out. And you can see it. I mean, actually, you can't see this. I think there was a suppression order on this particular part of the tape. But Khalid Mabali's final punch, like, knocks Davey's head back in this really sharp movement, and he just crumples to the ground. And he never regained consciousness after that. The fight was immediately called off, obviously. They called an ambulance. There was kind of chaos. People rushed to him, his father and his wife, and his wife's mother, who was an emergency room nurse. He went to hospital that night and was found to have a severe subdural hematoma, which is like pretty much like a brain bleed, that was really putting so much pressure on his brain. They said he's not going to survive. And 3 days later, he died. So I think the key issue that was interrogated, or one of the key issues that was interrogated in the inquest a couple of years later, sorry, my earphones had to pull out. The key issue that was interrogated in the inquest a couple of years later was whether Davey was concussed, whether everybody in the room that had a position of responsibility towards the fighters on the fight should have recognized that he was concussed, whether they should have then acted on it, and what they were responsible for doing, and if they did that, if they fulfilled that responsibility. So Davey's death kind of brought together, for me, as a outsider, as a journalist, as a boxer, as an observer, brought together a lot of issues about the sport, about how seriously we take things like head injury and concussion, brain injury to be more specific, whether we are sufficiently educated as sports people about the risks of that. Certainly in my experience in boxing, nobody ever told me how to identify a concussion. I did that myself. I learned myself. And I think the only reason, I don't think most people in boxing, I know most people in boxing don't teach themselves how to identify a concussion. In my opinion, it should be something that you're taught as soon as you start playing. But we can talk about that later. it was kind of the perfect, again, as a writer, using my writer's brain, my writer's kind of analysis, it was kind of the perfect example, the perfect incident to kind of like to draw out all of these issues and start talking about them. And I mean, it was happening in the media too. People were talking about these issues of the consequence of Davey's death because it was so obviously connected to that.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Yeah,
I don't know if I did. I answer your question?
No, you answered it. You answered it perfectly and really evocative. Like, my skin was tingling a little bit as you're describing it, as I'm thinking back to the book, because maybe it's my historian sense, but it's the moment encapsulates so many things, that so many issues with the sport of boxing, whether it's the venues, whether it's the promoters, whether it's the sport itself, or the nature of how the sport plays on our sensibilities and our sensitivities. I mean, for people who don't, your book covers this very well. And for reasons legal reasons in Australia, we don't have to get into who may or may not have violated any duties of care. If people should read the book to find full conclusions.
Yes, it's been very thoroughly legal. Yes.
Yeah. So we won't do any of that specifics here. But there's layers. I mean, so one of the things you talk about in the book is that, you know, Davy was winning on the cards. Like, and so there is a kind of sense that, like, you just need to survive one more round.
Yeah.
On the kind of like masculine sensibility of what boxing is all about. But at the same
time, endurance, like stamina, like you're tough. You can survive one more round. Like, you know, you've done 11 so far. What's a little knock, you know? That idea that you but if you just sort of tough it out, you'll get the glory.
But this one moment does encapsulate all these things. It does encapsulate all these things. And you can, as you show in the book, you know, some of these things have these long histories, like boxing's association with kind of the maybe less salubrious side of organizing sport, right? And how, not that there's anything particularly wrong in some ways with club venues or things like that, but because of that, boxing has been kind of shoved to a corner and then poorly regulated because it's not in the limelight until something like this happens. And so without talking in any specific about any particular person, can you walk us through a little bit about kind of how the coronial court and you in the book kind of deal with the issue of duty of care, and what are some of the ways in which kind of duty of care needed to be changed, or what are thinking about that? Is that a good way of putting that, of working that for you?
I mean, duty of care kind of came out, but if you've ever had any interactions with lawyers talking about duty of care, I think it can be very dry and almost feels like it's divorced from reality sometimes. And I think
lawyers dry.
Lawyers do a great and important job, but also, I think, like, so what the way the inquest played out was, everybody who had an official role at the fight was called to give evidence. That included the multiple representatives in the room of the Combat Sports Authority, which is the regulatory authority in New South Wales that oversees boxing. Not every state in Australia has, boxing is not officially regulated by the state in every state in Australia. It only happens in some states. And in New South Wales, it does. It is regulated by the government. So there were Combat Sports Authority representatives in the room. There were two. So they had to give evidence. There was a referee, obviously. There were the people who were in Davey's corner. That was Davey's trainer, Todd Mufflin, and his brother, Tommy. Davey's family were called to give evidence, as was Amy's mother, Davey's mother-in-law, because she had had a role and she'd seen it. She was there. Davey's dad, Davey's mom, Davey's wife, obviously, Amy, gave evidence. There was also a ringside doctor. So the ringside doctor was actually, in the final round, when Davey was knocked out, the ringside doctor was about 2 meters away. So there was a table where the judges, so they were also called, the people who were scoring the fight, they were called to give evidence. But in between those two judges, there was the doctor watching the fight. A lot of the questioning from the counsel, counsel assisting the coroner, and also from the coroner, a lot of the questioning was around what roles and responsibilities each of those people had, how well they understood those roles and responsibilities, what the government kind of mandated that they should or shouldn't do. And then a lot of questioning about concussion and head injury, and did they know how to identify a concussion? If they did know, when did they learn? Like, what kind of education had they had on that? Were there any structures for that to get a refresher on that sort of thing? So in some ways, all of this questioning was quite dry. Really, the part of the inquest that I found most compelling and most upsetting in some way, actually around the other way, it was upsetting and also kind of extraordinary was the doctor's evidence. So he was the only person who had an official role that night who had his own lawyer in the room. Oh no, that's not true. I'm sorry. The referee also did. But I believe that he had received legal counsel very late in the game, very late in the proceedings, I should say, not the game. They both gave evidence quite late in the proceedings, in the inquest proceedings, and the doctor's tone and attitude towards both boxing and his responsibilities that night was really quite off-putting from the point of view of an observer, but also I think the coroner. So the coroner openly criticized the doctor in her findings. I'll leave you to read the book if you want to kind of know more about what he said and why it was pretty upsetting. But he should have been watching. He should have been able to identify David's concussion. It was really obvious from any book, like from me as an outsider watching the video. He's wobbling. He was wobbling around. He couldn't defend himself properly. All of that was pretty clear signifiers of a concussion, and he didn't do that, and he didn't stop the fight. He didn't try to call the attention of any of the other officials to stop the fight. And I think that combined my reading of it, and this is my opinion, to be clear, I think that combined with his very dismissive tone on the stand was partly why the referee called him out for specific criticism in her finding. Sorry, not the referee, just the referee of the coronial inquest. Why the coroner called him out for specific criticism in her findings.
The part of the book that deals with the coronial court was fascinating for the ways in which it illuminated how much of the fight game doesn't know what the other half of the fight game is doing. No one even understood what rules they were fighting under.
Oh my gosh, yes.
The standing eight count or...
Yes, is it a standing eight count or a standard eight count? And
yeah,
which rules apply to these particular fights? Like, there's so many kind of tiny little nuances in the fight rules, depending on who's sanctioning the fight, which you know, organization of the alphabet soup is sanctioning the fight, what the local laws are around the sport and all of that. And yeah, when people on the stand were asked what are the rules, like, do you understand the rule, do you know the rules, they would sort of say yeah, but then when they were asked specifics about the rules, they wouldn't know.
Right, people who had been fighting their whole lives had fought hundreds of fights that didn't know the rules. And
yeah,
in one group we can openly, I mean, we can both openly criticize, it's the state government of New South Wales for not doing a very good job of regulating and effectively kind of working as an adjunct to the promoters, just kind of, you know, taking their word for it that they know what they're doing, and really not as a state entity kind of going, hey, we need to be checking into these, until it was far too late for Davey.
That's right. I do think that. So most of the coroner's recommendations did center around what the government should do and how they should be regulating the sport. I have to say very little has changed. They did introduce a thing called Davey's Law, which was accompanied by a big spread in the Daily Telegraph, as you can imagine. Daily Telegraph is a tabloid newspaper in New South Wales, in Australia.
Most interested in boxing as well. Most likely.
Yes.
The sport. Yeah.
That's right. But the substance of the changes that they had announced and they had pushed through were very, very minor. And by the time I finished writing this book, it was pretty clear that very little more was going to happen on this issue. And honestly, I do wonder if there would have been more potential for a bit more of kind of a push on that had COVID not happened around the time that this book came out, and when nobody was boxing because it's a contact sport and
yeah,
we weren't allowed to be in contact with anybody. So it was a bit unfortunate in that way. And I think kind of it was lucky in some ways for the government that the heat came off in that respect at that time. But obviously there were other things that we were worried about. So.
One of the best parts of the book for me was reading about you boxing, and because it presented a kind of alternative possibility for boxing in some way. So I wonder, you know, I don't want to take up too much more of your time, Stephanie, but maybe in the last 5 or so minutes, can you tell us a bit about, you know, the future of boxing from your perspective, what you learned? Because it seemed like you found boxing to be an empowering experience at times, but also a challenging experience.
I think the key to my sort of understanding about boxing was understanding violence and what it means to engage in violence from an ethical perspective. And I sort of came to the understanding in the end that there is no inherent moral quality to violence. That's a consequence of us being human and being able to imbue acts with moral meaning. Like we don't, I sort of talk about this. I have a cat. She likes to chase lizards. Like we don't condemn her for chasing a lizard and killing a lizard, right? I mean, we see that it is violent and it results in the death of the other animal, but, there's no kind of inherent moral, make her morally kind of responsible for that. I try not to let her do it, but that's my morality kind of playing out there by preventing her from killing this other animal. And there's all sorts of violence. There's a kind of adage that violence is bad and we don't condone violence. You hear it from politicians all the time. That they don't condone violence. Violence should never be condoned. But actually, politicians condone violence all the time. They just don't say, like, at the moment we're witnessing an absolute bombardment of Gaza in the Middle East, and there are so many politicians saying this is fine. This is, you know, what this the other country has the right to drop bombs on all of their civilians. That's condoning violence.
State, right? The nature of the state is violent. Who wants there to be police is condoning on some level violence, because that's just the nature of the way in which the state exercises power, right?
That's right. So I think all you need to do is kind of open your eyes to what actually happens in the world to understand that this is a lie that we tell ourselves, that we don't condone violence. So what does that mean? I think it means that there are circumstances in which we think violence is okay. And that might differ depending on where we sit in the power structure, where capitalism is built on violence. Where
if we keep going down this, we're just everything all the way
everything
down.
Is violent. But I think what I'm trying to get at, and what I was trying to get at in the book,
there are
circumstances in which engaging with violence in a controlled and consensual way. I think consent is really important. Informed consent is really important. Informed consent is really important for boxing, but by doing that, it's also really important if anything you're doing is violent or could be construed as violent. So engaging in a informed consensual fashion, in a controlled fashion, can be really empowering, because what the experience of violence does to your body is kind of transformative, and what does to your mind is kind of transformative. It's the most alive you'll ever feel. I don't actually know how else to describe it. So that is actually kind of, I feel like in some ways that's kind of a dangerous thing to say, and a dangerous position to put forward. And I think that's part of the reason why I spent a whole book trying to articulate it. And it doesn't mean that I think that everybody should go out and beat up their friends or whatever. The control, the consent is so key to that. But if you have those conditions and they're right, I feel like this can actually be a way to understand yourself better, a way to understand like being what it means to be human better. Because violence is such a key part of our society and our world. I think understanding it is really important, and not just kind of like chucking it in the too hard basket. What I wanted to do in this book was look it right in the face and kind of get past all of the sort of social conventions around it to really understand what we're dealing with when we talk about violence and when we engage in violence. And as a consequence of that, like most violence is not okay, you know, because most violence is not consensual, most violence is not controlled. Most violence is one very powerful person trying to gain more power over other people. Power, that power relationship is also really important, I think. Understanding power.
I just keep coming back in your book to that moment where you're doing your, it's not kind of your graduation, but you have to fight the three
fighters.
And
my black shirt thing.
And you're describing how nervous you are and how, and then you realize these other women are who have been training you are nervous of you.
Yes. I think that's also partly what we're socialized to be as women, right? To be nervous of that. But
getting over, like, you're breaking those negative social, you know, if boxing has negative influences in the way it interacts with masculinity, maybe it has positive influences in the way in which it challenges femininity.
Right, because I think that what we're socialized as women to consider our bodies inferior and weak, even if we think, oh, that's kind of crap. That so much of society tells us that that's what our bodies are, and engaging in something like boxing where you're explicitly using your body as a powerful tool, and as one that is has the potential to do to other people what everybody tells you that to be. Blunt that men are going to do to you, like that is not just empowering, but it's also it changes the way you feel about what your body is and how it can function. It changes the way you walk. It changes the way you think about things when you enter a room, I think. And that interaction between women can be so strange in those environments because it kind of goes against the grain of so much of what we're told about ourselves. It's funny because the women that I boxed with always were always very nice to each other, but when we actually got in the ring, we'd really try to hit hard. I think I actually wrote about this in the book. But every time I got into a sparring kind of training thing with a bloke, even if we were just using pads, and one of the ideas was to duck a punch or to slip a punch. So, you know, just try to avoid it when it came at your face. They would hold back. So they would throw the punch, but if you didn't move your head, they would stop the punch right before your nose. And I had to keep saying to these guys, I need you to try to punch me. Like, I need you to actually try to punch me, or you are not going to teach me anything. And I'm going to go and train with the girl over on the other side of the room, because if you're not trying to hit me, like, what are we doing here? It was funny. The best people to train with actually were other women, because even though the blokes might have been better fighters, they just treated you like kid gloves. And it was like, no, I don't want that. I want you to actually, like, help me be stronger by doing this thing that I am consenting to, right? Like, it's this is a consensual environment, and we're not going to try to give each other a concussion, but we are going to try to hit each other. I do think that is actually, something that we haven't really spoken very much about, but that is really key to the book is the understanding of concussion, the understanding of and repeated head trauma causing chronic traumatic encephalopathy, which is a degenerative brain disease. I think that in sport we haven't for a long time treated brain injury with the seriousness it needs to be treated, and that was one of the things that I wanted to do with this book, was to take it seriously and to make an argument for better education of sports people, of trainers, of everybody in every contact sport. I now play Australian rules football. I don't box anymore post COVID. I play footy, and even there, like, there is more discussion now than there ever has been about concussion and about what it is and how to deal with it. And how dangerous it can be, but it's still an uphill battle to get people to take it seriously, I think. And I really want more people to do that and to take their health seriously when they play these sports.
Yeah, this one of the things I really liked about this book is that meditative quality to it, that it wasn't an anti-boxing book. It wasn't just a pure account from a boxing kind of like, I don't know, a boxing tragic who wanted to talk about some fight in the past. But it's a kind of contemporary meditation on what boxing means in Australian society from a female perspective. And it does take seriously these questions of head trauma and CTE, and all the other kind of associated issues that, I mean, it's not, obviously there are other injuries as well that you describe in the book, just the general trauma that you get from sport, but it doesn't take that, it's not an abolitionist account. It's an account that says, actually, we have to foreground consent. We have to foreground informed consent. And if we do these things, you know, sport can still happen in a meaningful way, because there are benefits and there are costs, but we just have to kind of unshackle ourselves from some of the kind of, to use the term, I guess, toxic qualities that masculinity and boxing together can produce. I really loved it. Stephanie, the last question I always ask people is what do we have to look forward to next? You're writing all the time, though, because you're at the Inequalities journalist, Guardian Australia. But I feel rude asking you there's another book out there. But if there is, if you want to sprig anything, that was the time, please.
I am writing all the time. You can see my work almost daily. Not at the moment. I've been off work for a little while. But in terms of long form, I have actually been intermittently, very slowly working on a novel. I did train as a creative writer, not a journalist. And fiction is my first love. So during COVID, I decided that that's what my next thing would be, something completely different to what I had been doing. Don't hold your breath on when it's coming out though, because it isn't finished. I've got like 25,000 words and it needs a complete restructure. But yeah, that's what I'm working on.
Well, I mean, when you're fitting it in between all the amazing writing at The Guardian, it's impressive.
Thanks. And tiring.
Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us, Stephanie.
Thanks so much.
We've been talking today with Stephanie Convery, who's an author and inequality reporter for Guardian Australia. And she's also the author of After the Count, The Death of Davy Brown, out with Penguin in 2020. It's fantastic. Pick up a copy, read it, enjoy it, think about it. Thank you so much, Stephanie, for joining us.